Crime, Wine, and Chaos contains adult language and graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Maybe we're born with it. Maybe it's chaos, kids. I'm Naomi.
Excellent. I'm Amber. This is Crime, Wine, and Chaos.
Maybe hi, it sister.
Is chaos. Hi, sister.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I haven't seen your face in a while.
Yeah, it's been, I think we recorded it about the same time last week. So it's been about a week.
Yeah. I guess that's a while for us.
That is a while for us. I didn't see you on Thanksgiving. How was your Thanksgiving?
It was good. I cooked the whole kit and caboodle all by myself. I was really...
whole shebang? Nobody brought anything?
There was somebody brought dressing and somebody brought pie and somebody brought rolls, but I did everything else. And I loved it. Yeah, I loved it.
You did?
Yes.
You were in your happy place.
2 days. Yeah.
That's some Zen shit though, right? That's some real Zen shit.
Yeah. I actually prefer not to have any help. Just you can help me by staying out of the kitchen.
Just get out of my way.
And I'm just going for it, you know?
Yeah.
It was amazing. I am down with it.
You.
Thank you. How was your Thanksgiving?
Well, you know, I went low key. I just hung out with a couple of friends. We did have a meal the whole time. I felt kind of weird about it because I'm kind of at this place where I don't really think I want to celebrate Thanksgiving at all anymore. It's not, you know, the indigenous people of the United States call it the National Day of Mourning. They grieve. They use it as a day of grief and mourning because it marks the beginning of their genocide on this continent. So, you know, I'm starting to reevaluate how I want to use that day. And, I have a feeling next year it's going to look a little bit more different than it already does. But I mean, I had a good time. I spent time with a couple of my favorite people in the world who make me feel really good and made me feel very welcome at their house. And we watched a ridiculous movie and actually a couple, which was fun and, you know, kind of snuggle puddled on the couch and it was good.
Good.
It was good. What are you drinking?
Thank you for asking. This is a colossal. It's called Colossal Red from Caso Santos Lima.
Oh. Lima, Peru?
Yes. Also, it's from Costco. Costco's got a good selection.
Peru by way of Kirkland Signature.
Correct.
Fancy. Correct. Very fancy.
Yeah. I'm so fancy over here.
Yeah. You're dressing to the threes, baby.
Oh my God. I am dressed into the threes.
It's okay. It's okay. You've got a crime for me today?
I do have a crime. I feel like I just really love to, you know, think of the things that terrify me the most and then take a deep dive into it just to see how the rest of my day shakes out after.
You know, that's kind of like exposure therapy though, isn't it?
I think so. It's not working though.
Maybe you just have to keep doing it. You're not doing it enough.
I need more trauma. Okay, so this one's rough. We're going
to stalking case, isn't it?
It's stalking adjacent.
It's almost like I know your deepest fears.
I don't even, you know, I'm like a moth to a flame with these.
Okay.
So we are going to Ballarat, Australia.
Okay.
Which is just outside of Melbourne.
All right. Melbourne is the major city that's on the west coast of Australia, correct?
Yeah, and Sydney's the major city on the east, right?
Right.
Correct. So it's...
Or you're just outside of Melbourne.
We're in Ballarat. 100,000 people, roughly. It's friendly, tight-knit community, and homicide is very uncommon.
Okay.
So Sharon Searman was 29 years old. She had a little boy named Aaron, who she absolutely doted on. Her parents, John and Denise, said that Aaron was her whole world, and she was born to be a mom. He is a little pumpkin. He's a little cutie pie.
How old is he at the time of these events?
I think he's like four.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, so Sharon was the youngest of Denise and John's four children and the only girl. Sharon met Aaron's father at the age of 23. And after Aaron was born, there was just too much stress and strain on the relationship. And the couple separated when Aaron was three.
Okay.
I mean, I'm familiar with that.
Pretty normal.
Mm-hmm. She found a nice little rental house for her and Aaron and really embraced being a single mom. So she had been single for about a year when she decided to get back into the dating. So she gave online dating a try.
Oh, here we go. Amber, are you trying to tell me something?
I'm so scared.
Where else do you meet people anymore? Okay. You know what? Keep going.
Okay.
Okay.
So in January 2013, she met Jason Godfrey on a dating site. They texted back and forth for a while before they ever met in person. Jason told her that he had been single for 7 years. He said that he had a fiance that had passed away 7 years ago.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Meanwhile, in late 2012, so a few months prior, another local single mom, Sonia Beecham, was also online dating at the same time as Sharon. And she was in contact with Jason the same time that Sharon was. He had also contacted Sonia.
Okay.
Sonia
says, it's a numbers game. You talk to multiple people before. Yeah, that's how it's done.
Okay. All right. So far, so good.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
No red flags yet. Well, okay. No. One red flag so far is 7 years. That's a long time solo for any reason. You know, that's a long time solo.
Yeah. You're so good. So Sonia says that when she first met Jason, she didn't find him attractive and described him as rough around the edges. But she decided that she wasn't going to be judgmental, so she responded to him. And she said that the conversation was simple and he came across as a really genuinely kind person. And the first time they met in person was at a coffee shop.
That's also very normal.
Mm-hmm. She said the conversation was good. He seemed nice, no red flags. So she invited him back to her house. Everything went great. They had another cup of coffee and continued to visit for a while. And eventually he went home. No hanky-panky, nothing, just chill, good conversation, whatever, right?
Okay.
At this time, they were both still on the dating website and keeping their options open. And it was during this time that he started talking to Sharon.
Yeah, this all tracks.
Okay, great. Great. So it's mid-January 2013. Sharon and Jason have their first date meeting in person. Sharon's mom, Denise, wasn't concerned about Sharon's online dating, but she did tell her, just don't bring anyone back to your house right away.
Right.
Yeah.
For like multiple reasons. You wouldn't do that anyway, right? She has a 4-year-old at home or whatever.
Right. So Jason had told Sharon that he lived in Beaufort, which is about 30 minutes away. So Sharon's dad was like, oh, a nice country boy. That sounds nice.
Uh-oh.
Mm-hmm. So Jason took the train in and the two met for the first time at the train station. So according to Kim Quinlan, who is a local journalist, Sharon felt uneasy about Jason right away. His profile picture did not match who she was looking at. His hair was a mess. He had missing teeth. His clothes were a mess. And Sharon was a little bit embarrassed to be seen with him in public.
Oh, no.
What do you do when someone just took a 30-minute train ride and the second you see them, it's like, nope.
I mean, this is why you have to have like contingencies in place to get out of it. Like you need to be able to send up a flare, like a digital flare, and have a phone call come in that removes you immediately from the situation.
But so do you
legitimately have to go?
Oh, for sure. But do you do like a FaceTime call first? Like, do you start with text and then graduate to like a FaceTime call and then meet in person. I don't even understand why people do this. Like, they're going to see you.
The catfishing thing. Yeah, it's weird. It's always been really weird to me. I'm not really sure what they think that they're going to get out of it, especially with men. It makes me like scared of them more because like, what are your intentions if you're going to like lie to get me to be in person with you? Like, what else are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know, Amber. I'm not really sure. But like, you know, I mean, it's like tangentially, it reminds me of Tanya Head. Remember her? The 9/11 gal, just like making up a whole fucking life that like eventually everybody figured out the truth. Like eventually people figure out the truth. So I don't know. I can't wrap my head around that pathology or that thought process.
Mm-mm. So she's embarrassed to be seen with him. So she offers to go back to her house with him.
What?
So that she's not in public with him. I know.
Oh.
So after a few hours of hanging out, she was not feeling right about him. So she goes into the other room and phones a friend. And she has her friend call and say that Aaron was sick and she needed to come and get him.
Yep.
So she did that. She dropped Jason off at the train station and that was it. She had no intention of ever seeing him again.
Block.
Yeah.
Block, disconnect, yep. Block.
Mm-hmm.
Except now he knows where she lives.
Okay. Yep. So the next day she's telling her mom about this Jason guy and how he showed up on the date. And her mom said that her and Sharon like had a good laugh about it. The two had lunch together and she was like, oh my God, he was missing teeth and all the things. Right. But she didn't tell her mom that she had brought him back to her house.
Well, of course she didn't tell her mom that. I don't blame her.
Yeah. So she doesn't contact Jason again. And it's during this time that Sonia and Jason are starting to get more of a relationship going on. Sonia says that he treated her wonderfully. Jason met her mom and her mom liked him. Her
so
friends-
Sonia was not turned off by the lack of teeth or the messy hair or any of it.
No, she was initially, but she was, I like Sonia. She was like, look, I'm not, you know, Beyonce or anything. So I can
give this person a shot. Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, no judgment. Just interesting. Just interesting how the two women had such a different take, you know?
You know, yeah, they're, you know.
Not just that, like, Sonia was willing to give this guy a chance, even though he didn't look how she would maybe want him to. But also that she didn't have any instincts about this guy not being on the up and up or whatever.
We
you know?
Have talked about this. That is a learned thing. Your natural instincts only go so deep.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
So they're doing their thing. And yeah, her friends liked him. Mom liked him. Sonia says the relationship was wonderful. And as they got closer, Jason starts to tell her about his troubled past. He told her that he had been in jail before, and according to Sonia, she says that a lot of people have made poor decisions in their past, and people deserve second chances.
Hey, look, one of my best friends is still serving prison time right now. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people end up in prison for things that I don't necessarily think they need to be in prison for, so...
Nope.
Just being in prison does not, having spent time in prison doesn't necessarily correlate to your character, really.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. So hard to balance that though, right? Like that would be a red flag where you would be like, bye, but also you don't want to be that person.
Well, yeah. And it's like, it's so circumstantial. There's nuance. There's nuance.
Yeah, totally. So she also kind of gets the impression that his criminal past was like drug related and petty theft and things like that, right?
Right. Things that aren't dangerous, where somebody needs to be separated from society. I mean, and let's not even get into the notion of the fact that like the way our, you know, at least in the States, I don't know what it's like in Australia, but I can't imagine it's much better. Like prison is not, even for people who quote unquote deserve to be separated from society, it's not good for people. It's not meant for human beings. So yeah. Anyway, tangent.
No, that's okay. So she says, of course, in hindsight, Jason was a master at deception.
Right.
She said she always thought that she was good at trusting her instincts and a good judge of character, but she had no indication that anything was wrong with him. So Jason Godfrey doesn't actually exist. His real name is Jason Dinsley, and he had a violent criminal past. In fact, he was let out of prison August of 2012, just months before meeting Sonia and Sharon. And because he had such an unsavory past, when he got out of prison, he moved to a new location, took on a new name, and started telling a new narrative of himself online, which is that I've been off the grid for 7 years because my fiance died, when in fact he was in prison for 7 years. Yeah.
There it is. Okay. All right. That's, yep. Okay.
Yeah. And by March of 2013, so a few months into his relationship with Sonia, he was already slipping back into some of his criminal behavior. He had violated parole by using drugs and alcohol and whatever, right? So it is now Friday, April 5th, 2013. It's been 3 months since Jason and Sharon's one and only date.
Okay.
She went out shopping with the paternal grandma and then went to her parents' house afterwards to show them what Aaron had got with his other grandma. She stayed for dinner at her parents' house, and she invited her mom to come over the following morning to garden with her. This is sad. Denise says that Sharon and Aaron left their house around 8 p.m., and she can still remember them both waving out the car window as they drove away and they were honking the horn. That was the last that she saw of Sharon. So Sharon's friend and neighbor across the street, Mark Kaliva, I like this guy, he seems like a pumpkin, says that his partner's dog had just given birth to a litter of 10 puppies, and he had been staying the night at their house, and the puppies were noisy, and he was sleep deprived. So it was on this night, the night of April 5th, Friday, that he returned to his own home.
Because he needed a good night's sleep.
Yeah. He said when he got home that night, he didn't see or hear anything unusual. He just went inside and went straight to bed, and he was out. The following morning, Sharon's dad was driving home from a round of golf, and he happened to go past Sharon's street on his way home. And when he went by, he saw a large police presence on her street. That is when her dad, John, gets a call from the neighbor, Mark. And Mark says, there is a detective here that wants to speak to you.
Oh, fuck.
I know. He said that as soon as he heard that, his stomach dropped. So it was, they didn't really give a clear indication. It said Aaron's nanny, who was also Sharon's partner at the time. So I don't know who had discovered Sharon. When they arrived at Sharon's that day, they noticed the back door was open and there was blood in the house. That's when Aaron ran to them and said, Mommy won't wake up and get breakfast.
Oh no.
So the partner took Aaron outside and went back in after Aaron was outside safely and found Sharon deceased in her bedroom. Yeah. Her estimated time of death was very close to the time that her neighbor Mark had arrived home. And he says that he wishes he had arrived 10 minutes earlier or 10 minutes later so that he could have seen what was going on and intervened. Like, he has so much guilt.
I know.
So the only witness is 4-year-old Aaron. He told the police that someone broke into Mommy's house by bashing it with a bat and stole Mommy's phone.
Oh, God.
Then he said the man hit Mommy with the bat and she screamed like an eagle.
Oh, I know.
So Aaron made the very smart decision to go into his room and stay there. And like, he didn't come out until the nanny came the next morning.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
This poor little thing.
I know. So the first thing police do is look at anyone that Sharon was or had recently dated. So they start going through her computer and they start looking at these dating sites. There were other men that Sharon had dated more recently, so at first, Jason wasn't on their radar.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The forensic pathologist noted a number of injuries to the head, arms, legs, and Sharon was brutally attacked. She was beaten with a bat.
Jesus Christ.
It was a prolonged, sustained attack, and It was major overkill, which indicated someone who was pissed and who had fucking lost it on her, right?
Yep.
So across town, Sonia is still loving it up with Jason and everything's great. She said his behavior was the same as it had always been. And at the time, Sharon's murder was all over the news because it was so rare in this area. And Sonia said that her and Jason even discussed the case and how it was so awful and her family and her son and how terrible it was.
This fucking guy.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez, I can't.
Yeah. So the police also learned from Aaron that the intruder took Sharon's phone. So they call her service provider and try to get a location on the phone. This is like dark. So cut back to Sonia. She says that her and her friends would regularly play games on their, they all had like iPhones, right?
Right.
And Jason had like an older like flip phone and he didn't have any game options and he wanted to play. So Sonia remembers on Saturday, April 6th, so the day after, Jason asked her if she would drive him to his friend's house because he had an iPhone that he was going to sell him for $50. So they get to this house where Sonia has never been. The friend isn't home and Jason tells Sonia, I'm just going to go in and grab the phone and leave the money for him. So he gets back in the car and he has an iPhone with a purple sparkle cover on it.
Stop it.
And Sonia says the two of them had a good laugh about it and was like, why does your mate, because she's assuming it's a dude, have a purple sparkle case? And Sonia had a red case on her phone. So her and Jason switched cases.
Oh,
I know. I know.
That is. Oh, no. Oh, Sonia. Oh, Sonia.
I know. So by Monday, April 8th, 2 days after Sharon's murder, Jason stupidly fucking turns on the phone, which gives the police the ping on his location.
So he's just started using this phone?
Mm-hmm.
Like it was his?
Yeah. Well, also that might be another like unintended consequence of being in prison for 7 years is like he doesn't understand technology. I don't think he's evolved with like how that works. You know what I mean?
Obviously.
Like you can't, you can't just do that. So they're at his address and go like they swarm his house immediately, go inside and arrest him. Sonia was there when the police arrived and she said there was like 6 to 8 officers out of nowhere that just barged in and she had no idea what was happening.
Is this an Evil Lives Here story?
No, this is not.
Okay.
I promised that I would look elsewhere.
Sorry. Jesus, can you even? No, I mean, no of course no. Not. We cannot imagine.
I have that in my, that's my next sentence. Can you imagine?
No, we cannot imagine.
And they tell her he's being arrested for murder. And she's like, excuse me. So this fucking piece of shit, he had close to 150 convictions.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
How old was this guy?
Like 30 something.
Shit. He's prolific.
And his 7-year prison sentence, the most recent one, was for viciously raping a 52-year-old woman.
Oh my God. 7 years. That's what he got.
Yeah. So he tells the officers that on the night of Sharon's murder, he decided to go for a walk and just ended up at Sharon's house. Yeah.
Okay.
And then, you know,
with a baseball bat in tow.
No, not at this time. So, and of course he instantly becomes enraged because of the rejection of Sharon 3 months prior.
Do not even get me started.
Men and their fucking rejection. So he goes back to his house to find a weapon and returned to Sharon's with his bat.
Oh,
Yeah, the total time for this was 40 minutes. And at no point did he fucking calm down from his rejection.
Do you know, there are just a lot of mentally ill men on this planet. Mm-hmm. Mentally ill. They need fucking help.
Mm-hmm.
They yep. need fucking help. They are a health hazard to the rest of us.
Yeah. Yeah. It. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he used his pocket knife to pry open a window, which woke Sharon up, and she confronted him right away. And it was her scream that woke up 4-year-old Aaron.
Oh.
Jason said that he tried to rape her, but he couldn't get an erection, which enraged him further, which is why there was the overkill.
I don't even have words.
So poor Sonia obviously learns all of this. She learns that she has this deceased woman's phone case. Not only that, but she said, like, in the weeks prior, she was really sick and Jason took care of her. Like, he was just a doting angel of a partner. And one of Sonia's really good friends took Jason to buy a new cricket bat as a thank you. And that was the bat that he used.
It's so, like, I am having a visceral, like, physical reaction to all of this information.
I don't know how Sonia ever, I would be just, I'm never dating anybody again. Like, I obviously don't have, I don't, my body contains no instincts. Like, what the fuck? That poor woman.
I can't.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. Yeah. So Jason Dinsley was sentenced to 32 years for the murder of Sharon, and Aaron lives with Sharon's parents. That is the horrific murder of Sharon Searman.
I follow this gal on TikTok, and she's Australian, and she's basically dedicated one of her TikTok accounts and part of her life to what she calls the rampant femicide problem in Australia.
Mm. Really?
Mm-hmm. And I don't think that Australia is unique. We've talked about this a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Australia is like the US and still doesn't have femicide as a crime specifically on the books or not.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh my God, it's just fucking men.
I don't know. I know. I just, yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Poor Sharon.
One date, and he's in a relationship with somebody else. Like, really, dude? What the fuck is that?
I mean, it's that classic quote, right? Men are afraid that women will laugh at them, and women are afraid that men will kill them. Yep.
But it's like, no one was even laughing at him. Like, that's the normal dating process. Like, you might go on a date with several people and be like,
this guy's not normal. And before he went to prison, there wasn't really online dating going on.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know what the fuck he was doing. You know what I mean? Like, there mm-hmm. was so much stuntedness there.
Yeah. But it's not even like, I mean, I know I'm trying to reason with an unreasonable person. Like, she wasn't even unkind to him. Like, it was just like, we don't click. Not you're gross. Not, you know what I mean? Like, just we don't click.
She didn't laugh at him. She didn't tell him to fuck off. She spent time with him and then they just didn't go out on any more dates.
Yeah. She feigned interest and she made up a lie so that his feelings wouldn't be hurt.
Yeah. And I've done plenty of those. Like, we got coffee, we hung out, and then we never spoke again. That happened.
And to think that you can fucking do that and your life is in danger. What?
Well, I mean, we've talked about this, Amber. Our life is in danger because we exist on this planet with vaginas.
No, I fucking hate it. I don't hate having a vagina, but I hate it.
No, I mean, sometimes I hate having a vagina, but not.
Samesies.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, I know, I know.
I'm just saying I'm so tired of the fucking.
Or femme presenting at all, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not even just vaginas. Just.
She couldn't have done it kinder. You know?
Well, yeah, it has nothing to do with it. It's not about her or what she did or didn't do. There's no, you know what I mean? Like,
I do know what you mean, but I think here's the thing.
Like, even if she had rejected him in the most cruel fucking way, she still didn't earn that.
No, absolutely not. Right? I think that people naturally want to think that they can somehow be safeguarded from that. So you look for. And you know,
there's no safeguarding. Clearly. No, there's not. No safeguarding. there's no safeguarding. You just kind of cross your fingers, say a little prayer or whatever you do for, you know, connecting with the universe or your God, and just hope it doesn't happen to you. I mean, literally, that's what we do. That's how we mm-hmm. get through life. We mm-hmm. just hope it doesn't happen to us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sister, thanks for that.
You're welcome.
I have chaos for you.
Okay.
I am not lightening the mood.
Oh.
Sorry. Okay. We're on a roll these days.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard of a group called MOVE?
No.
Okay. So MOVE was a communal organization that advocated for nature laws and natural living. They were originally called the Christian Movement for Life and founded in 1972 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania by John Africa.
Okay.
John was actually born Vincent Leaphart in July of 1931 in West Philadelphia. His dad was a handyman and his mom was, you know, the stay-at-home parent to their 10 children.
Whoa.
John's mom died suddenly and unexpectedly in her early 40s. And in later years, John would blame the hospital for her death. John, in his childhood, was described as painfully thin and underweight. And at the age of 9, he was sent to a school for slow learners to learn simple trades. But he struggled in school and dropped out at the age of 16. He was drafted into the Korean War and served 1 year in an infantry unit. Very soon after his return from the war, he met and married Dorothy Clark when he was 29. Dorothy described their marriage as ordinary, their friends saying that John was level-headed and dependable. Dorothy helped John get better with reading and writing. In 1971, John moved his family to Powelltown in West Philadelphia, close to the University of Pennsylvania. Wiki describes Powelltown as a polyglot neighborhood.
What?
Polyglot means multilingual. So I think that's Wiki's kind of bland way of saying that Powelltown was a diverse neighborhood with many languages and cultures represented in its residents.
Okay.
Not long after, John was facing foreclosure on his home and Community Housing Incorporated stepped in to help. Community Housing Inc. was a cooperative where the members pooled their money together to buy buildings to live in as a rebellion against an oppressive society that bulldozed homes to make way for more academic housing in the neighborhood.
Is that an organization that still exists?
I don't know.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. So I think kind of the implication here is that like this housing's affordable, right? Mm-hmm. When you talk about a multilingual, multicultural neighborhood, you're talking about probably like, you know, a Black community and an immigrant community that are like maybe lower income earners and they can afford to live there. And it's next to the university that wants to like tear down these old row houses and, you know, build new stuff for like mm-hmm. its faculty and its students.
Right. Yep.
So in the next year, 1972, John would change his name from Vincent Leaphart to John Africa. And he made friends with a man named Donald Glassie, who was a social worker from the college. He was super into John's teachings. Donald volunteered to write and compile John's thoughts into a book since John was still basically functionally illiterate.
When did John acquire teachings? He has teachings?
He definitely, I don't know when he acquired his teachings.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
I can't fill in that blank for you. Somewhere along the way, John had formed his own philosophy about life.
Gotcha. All right.
And Donald Glassie was like, yeah, that's righteous, dude. And so they became besties. And Donald was writing and down like John's stuff, right, to make a book because John was still basically illiterate. I mean, he was functional, but he mm-hmm. couldn't read and write that well. So these notes that Donald took would become the basis of a document called the Guidelines. And this was when this new organization started forming. And John mm-hmm. and Donald moved this budding endeavor to a house on Pearl Street in West Philadelphia. But then Donald and John parted ways. They had disagreements in ideology, as is often the way in such things, right? John made the Guidelines the primary source for his teachings and the principles of MOVE, which is always spelled in all caps, but it's not an acronym. So MOVE was officially founded in 1972 as the Christian Movement for Life or Living. What did I say it was? I think I wrote it wrong.
thought you said for life the first time, but
it's for life. You're right. Sorry. End up? Okay. So some of the guidelines included strict vegetarianism and the inherent value of all living things. MOVE was super inclusive. Anyone who wanted to join could, regardless of their past. And the lessons taught at MOVE included topics of corruption, racism, and the need for individuality in an increasingly technological society. MOVE also protested things like animal cruelty in zoos, the education system, and police brutality.
This is why cults are dangerous, because so far I'm on board with all of this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in a 2018 article about the group by Ed Pilkington in The Guardian, Ed described their views as, quote, a strange fusion of black power and flower power. The group that formed in the early 1970s melded the revolutionary ideology of the Black Panthers with the nature and animal loving communalism of the 1960s hippies. You might characterize them as black liberationists come eco warriors.
It sounds very similar to Jonestown.
Kind of.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Ed had also received a letter from one MOVE member who was still serving a prison sentence, Janine Africa, when he was writing this article, right around the time he wrote this article in 2018. And she said to him, quote, we demonstrated against puppy mills, zoos, circuses, any form of enslavement of animals. We demonstrated against Three Mile Island and industrial pollution. We demonstrated against police brutality, and we did so uncompromisingly. Slavery never ended. It was just disguised.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone who joined MOVE took on the surname Africa. So if they changed their first name or not, they all changed their last name to Africa.
Uh-huh. I'm familiar with this practice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the police in Philadelphia engaged in heavy surveillance of the members of MOVE, to probably no one's surprise. In fact, in the documentary film Let the Fire Burn, one member of the Philly PD admitted that between 1972 and 1978, they made 193 arrests of MOVE members, resulting in 93 court cases.
Jesus.
In 1977, three MOVE members were jailed for inciting a riot, which just raised the tensions between MOVE and law enforcement. And I did not get the details on this particular incident, but I really got to say, I questioned these charges and what the motivation, what the grounds for these charges were.
Right.
And this brought more protests and more armed displays from the group, supposedly. They did have weapons. I don't know how much. So that same year, Philly PD got themselves a court order to evict MOVE from the Powelltown property based on a bunch of complaints from their neighbors, supposedly. Mm-hmm. MOVE agreed to leave and turn over their weapons, but only if the police released their members who were at that time being held in city jail.
Okay.
So in August of 78, the Philly PD tried to evict the remaining MOVE members from the Powelltown home on Pearl Street. And a standoff ensued, and this led to a shootout and the death of one police officer, as well as several injuries. On the day of the shooting, a MOVE member named Delbert Africa was beaten severely by police. MOVE claimed that they were not responsible for the officer's death that was shot, and that it was the result of his fellow officers. In that same Guardian article our friend Ed wrote in 2018, there were eyewitnesses that said that the fatal shot didn't come from the house, but from the police outside the house. And MOVE members claimed that they had no workable guns in their house at the time of this standoff. MOVE also asserted that everyone in the house was in the basement at the time that the police officer was shot, and the officer was up on street level. And it was also established that the officer was shot at a downward angle, meaning that the bullet came from above him, which would be impossible to do from the basement.
Oh, God, I don't like this at all.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Prosecutors argued differently, of course. This resulted in 9 members of MOVE being arrested and MOVE being successfully removed from the Pearl Street home. Immediately following this eviction, the home was demolished.
They couldn't establish that the bullet was from one of the officer's guns?
I mean, they could, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay.
The MOVE 9, as they would be called, were convicted for that police officer's death. Each of the 9 received a maximum sentence of 100 years. And the 3 officers that beat Delbert were acquitted of their charges.
Fuck right off.
Then John's ex-friend, Donald Glassie, was found in possession of weapons and arrested, and he then threw John and other MOVE members under the bus, ratting them out for various crimes. John and a I bet you they knew his connections to them somehow and like mm-hmm. twisted him and like yep. reduced his charges if he would give up some shit on John and yep. other MOVE members.
Used right? him as an informant. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So John and a co-defendant, another MOVE member by the name of Alfonso Africa, represented themselves in Philadelphia federal court in July of 1981 for charges on weapons and conspiracy of some sort. The jury deliberated almost 6 days and both men were acquitted.
Oh, okay.
That same year, 1981, MOVE relocated to a row house on Osage Avenue in the Cobbs Creek neighborhood of West Philly. Neighbors complained for years about trash around their building, confrontations with neighbors, and bullhorn announcements of sometimes, quote, obscene political messages by MOVE members. But according to one MOVE member, Ramona Africa, in a Vice documentary published on YouTube 3 years ago, none of that was true. MOVE was getting along just fine with their neighbors. Ramona says that all these supposed complaints were claimed by the police department and the local news stations.
Mm-hmm.
It was clear that the Philly PD, along with the mayor of Philly, was determined to get these people the fuck out because, let's be real, they were Black and they were different, and that's what has always happened to groups of Black Americans trying to get together and do something for themselves.
Yeah.
And in 1985, Philly PD obtained arrest warrants for four MOVE members living in the MOVE house. The crimes included parole violations, contempt of court, illegal possession of firearms, and making terrorist threats.
Okay. Making fucking terrorist threats with the bullhorn?
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The Philadelphia mayor and the police chief classified MOVE as a terrorist organization. Before police moved in to execute their warrants, they evacuated residents of the area and told the residents they would be able to return to their homes after 24 hours.
Oh, they fucking had a plan in place then.
They sure did.
I don't like it.
You shouldn't. On Sunday, May 12th, 1985, it was Mother's Day.
Mm.
Nearly 500 police officers, along with the city manager, arrived in force and attempted to clear the building and execute the arrest warrants. They shut off electricity and water to try to force the MOVE members out of their house.
Mm-hmm.
They kept the house surrounded all day, not doing much that I could tell, and then night fell. And the police commissioner read a big old speech over a bullhorn that started with, quote, "Attention, MOVE. This is America. You have to abide by the laws of the United States."
Oh, how are they not? I hate everything.
These are great questions, Amber.
Thank you.
The cops told them they had 15 minutes to get out of the house. At this time, there were 7 adults and 6 children in the house.
Oh, no.
The MOVE members did not respond. They did not come out of the house. From what I can gather, this kind of waiting continued until about 6 a.m. the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
Ramona said in the Vice documentary that they were afraid to leave the house because they were certain that if they walked out that door, they would be killed.
Of course. There's 500 officers out there.
Yeah.
I would be afraid too.
Yeah. So at 6 a.m., the morning of May 13th, 1985, is when the police started tossing tear gas canisters at and into the house. There were also water cannons brought in. By this time, all the people in the house were gathered in the basement, which started to fill with water and tear gas.
Oh.
And the kids had wet blankets over them just so they could try to breathe.
Yeah.
Ramona says the cops blew a hole in the side of the house next to theirs to try to get to them from the side. We're talking about like row houses, right? Mm-hmm. So there's barely like an arm's length width of alley between these houses. They're like, right. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And they're like multi-story houses. They're like 2 or 3 story, kind of like what they would call like a walk up in New York, but mm-hmm. like not butted up against each other. There's a little space in between them, but you know, you can see it. You know what right. I'm talking about, like old, mm-hmm. right? So The Move family tried to leave the house to get the kids out, especially, but I think they were trying to leave out the back, and the cops had decided that they wanted them to all leave out the front. So they shot at them when they tried to exit through the back of the house.
What the fuck? So after that many hours of wanting them out, now they're getting out incorrectly?
That's right.
Okay. Sure.
That's right.
Piece of shit.
And then a 90-minute gunfight began. At least that's what the police call it. I couldn't find footage or information that corroborated that this was a two-way street gunfight.
Mm-hmm.
But what we do know is that police used more than 10,000 rounds of ammunition.
Yeah, that's an ambush, not a fight.
Right. Philly PD had this Move group way outgunned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 7 adults and 6 children to 500 armed officers. Yes.
Who are all shooting for like an hour and a half, and like together combined, they shoot off 10,000 bullets. 10,000 bullets.
That's fucking ridiculous and unnecessary.
One officer was hit in the back, but he was fine. And personally, I'm not convinced he wasn't shot by a fellow officer with the amount of willy-nilly firing that was going on for an hour and a half with these guys.
Mm-hmm. No kidding.
Oh, God. And then at 2 p.m., sorry, it just gets worse, the police commissioner ordered the house to be bombed.
I'm sorry. They're just in a neighborhood and we're going to drop a bomb?
That's right. They dropped 2 bombs onto the roof of the house from a helicopter. They were 1.5-pound bombs that the police called, quote, entry devices, which were made of Tovix. Tovix is a dynamite substitute. And these were combined with 2 pounds of C fucking 4 that they got from the FBI.
Dynamite.
Uh-huh.
Cool.
Plastic explosives.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess there was what is described as a fortified bunker on the roof of the house. That's what the police called it. And this was the target for the bombs.
Okay.
But what happened was these explosions ignited the gas in a generator that was also on the roof, which of course set the house on fire.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the police just let it burn.
No.
For like an hour and a half before the police commissioner finally called in the fire department to start working on putting it out.
No way.
Yes,
an
way.
An hour and a half. Oh, my God.
Later, they would say, the police and the city would say, that they did this so that the fire would burn through and collapse the roof so they could toss more tear gas into the house from the burnt out roof hole.
Is that fucking necessary at this point?
Hmm. And of course, all the residents in this neighborhood and looky-loos, they're all standing outside this police perimeter and they're screaming at them to send in firefighters. They're watching the Philly Police Department do nothing but let this house burn.
Oh, there's kids in there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.
Of course, the Move members again try to leave the house. They have 6 children in there and they are hollering at the police that they are coming out. They're bringing the children out. And they were met with gunshots again.
No. What the fuck are they supposed to do?
Mm-hmm.
This is pissing me off.
Ramona grabbed one of the kids named Birdie, this little boy, and she managed to escape the blazing inferno with him. Ramona says the police grabbed her, slapped handcuffs on her burnt arms, threw her in a police car. They also grabbed Birdie, put him in a police van, and Ramona never saw him again.
What?
Mm-hmm. At the hospital being treated for her burns, Ramona kept waiting to see other of her Move family come in after her, and none of them did.
No.
5 children and 6 adults died in the fire.
Those were the only 2 that survived?
Yes.
And, oh, my God.
Yes. By the time the firefighters finally got the fire out, more than 2 city blocks of row houses had been burned to the ground. 61 houses burned to the ground.
These assholes.
But this burned down neighborhood wasn't treated like a crime scene.
Of course not.
Instead, the next morning, the city sent out a big old crane and started scooping up the debris like it was just another regular pile of trash.
Jesus Christ.
It wasn't until in the afternoon when someone saw a human leg dangling from the crane's bucket that an assistant medical examiner was sent to the scene.
They didn't even retrieve the bodies first?
Nope.
What kind of fucking disrespect? Oh my God.
I mean, I'm just going to point out that all the MOVE members were black and all of the police officers and the police commissioner and the mayor were white.
Mm-hmm.
Just going to say that in case that wasn't clear.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was just a mess of three different agencies with no organized effort at all and no real evidence gathering at any level that we would expect from a city or a police department.
Mm-hmm.
Or a coroner's department or anything. The bones weren't properly photographed or stored, and it was just a sloppy, lazy shit show.
Right.
So I'm just going to read these paragraphs straight from the New Yorker article that I found.
Okay.
Because it sums some things up pretty well here. How the scene was handled mattered. Indeed, the stakes couldn't have been higher. The police claimed that when they dropped the bomb on 6221 Osage, they simply wanted to dislodge a bunker on the roof. They had never wanted to ignite the whole house, they insisted, and were, of course, devastated that people had been killed. The deaths that day had been an accident. But the more details surfaced, the less that the police officers' claims satisfied the public. By June, the mayor had appointed the Philadelphia Special Investigation Commission on MOVE to get to the bottom of why the disaster had happened, who was responsible, and how so many people had died. During hearings, it was revealed that the police had known there were cans of gasoline on the roof where they dropped the explosives. Then came the disturbing testimony of the fire commissioner, William C. Richmond. Once the fire had begun, Richmond said, the police commissioner, Gregor Sambor, instructed him to let it burn. Most troublingly, there was a real possibility that these remains might show that MOVE members hadn't died by fire at all. It could be that some people in the house had been shot to death trying to flee the inferno by members of the Philadelphia Police Department, who were now saying that this had all been a terrible accident.
Fucking liars.
Mm-hmm. Bertie and Ramona told the exact same story of yelling that they were coming out and that as soon as they got to the doorway to leave that they were shot at. None of that mattered to Philadelphia officials. The remains that were recovered were examined and some were found to have gunshot wounds. In the end, the Philadelphia County Grand Jury declined to indict anyone. The city paid $33 million. To rebuild the burned down homes on the taxpayers' dime, of course. Mm-hmm. And the work was shoddy. They had sinking foundations and leaking roofs, and they looked like project housing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't need to tell you that this was a predominantly black neighborhood, right?
Right, right.
Okay. Just we're all on the same page here. Two of the MOVE 9, Merle Africa and Phil Africa, died in the Pennsylvania prison system. The other seven were released in February of 2020.
Wow, that's pretty recent.
Uh-huh. No one was ever charged in any way for the death of those 11 people on that horrible day in May of 1985.
God.
Ramona was charged and put on trial for arson, conspiracy, and basically everything that the police did.
Arson?
Uh-huh.
What the fuck? What arson?
Right?
I'm so fucking mad.
She was found guilty. She was found guilty and she was sentenced to 16 months or up to 7 years. And she did the whole 7 years.
Oh my
God. And then just to add the biggest insult to this injury in 2021, 36 years after 11 MOVE members were massacred in their home by the Philadelphia Police Department, family members of one of the children that was killed found out that they had not received her remains when they thought that they had buried her. She was called Tree Africa, and her bones had been held all this time at the Penn Museum and used in some anthropological class for some time. One of the guys who was supposed to be identifying the bodies based on their bones had taken all these bones and identified all these bodies and then just accidentally, for whatever reason, failed to return her bones to them.
No.
And had kept them for himself, and his assistant had used them in like classroom settings.
Oh my God. What did this family have? Just random bones? What did they have?
Well, I think that there were two children and they got the remains of one, but because it was all charred and small amount, right?
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Her remains were finally returned to her brother in April of 2022. The museum and the doctor or professor or whatever who had kept all the her remains all this time, they had supposed reasons, but like no one cares about the reasons.
No.
It's just wow. And that is the story of what is called the 1985 MOVE bombing.
Well, that was fucking terrible.
1985, Amber.
Wasn't that long ago. We were on this planet.
We were alive.
Wow.
When they decimated an entire neighborhood because a group of black people wanted to live differently and live together and like look out for each other.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In Philadelphia. In Philadelphia.
Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. That was fucking terrible. Thank you for that.
You're so welcome. Hey, look, you know what? You know, I'm on a mission, so. Be prepared for more like that.
Okay. I might try and offset it with maybe things that aren't so dark.
Oh, this is the one who just told us about this brutal murder.
I mean, starting today. Starting now. Oh my God.
Oh man. Sister. Well, you know, look, if we're going to do this, we should just do it, you know? Well, sister, I love you.
Love you.
Go to the order. You guys, if you haven't gone to rate us in the app where you listen to us, we'd love it if you did that. If you're on an Apple product and you go into that Apple podcast, you can like typey a review, even better.
Yeah. Yes, we love it. And join the Patreon if you want to check out our bonus content.
Bonus content. Every month we drop a whole episode that you gotta be a part of the club to listen to. And that's now right. That we have 20 members, we owe you guys a virtual wine night. We didn't forget about you. It's coming.
Yeah.
That's happening. We're on all the things. We're on the Facebook and the Insta and the X and TikTok. We have TikTok. You can find us there. Hey, you want to talk to us about something? You want to really get into it with us? You can send us an email. Amber reads the love letters. I read the hate mail. They all go to crimewineandchaos@gmail.com. Sister.
Oof.
That was chaotic.
Chaotic.
It was chaotic. I love you. I love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye. By 8th Direction Records. Artwork by Joshua M. Davis. Music by Paul Abner. If you would like to support the show, you can visit our Patreon page at crimewineandchaos.com/Patreon. Cheers. I just made you tiny. Oh, there you go.
Oh.